I guess I'm ready to start. We've begun a series. You've heard three messages already. That's the series seeks to explore the world of the Bible. And what do we mean? Well, we mean that we want to know what the world was like and what the people were like and why they thought the things they thought. What were the worldviews? How did the authors of the books of the Bible address the prevailing worldviews? What was going on in the ancient Near East around the people of the Bible? What were their concerns? And we want to do that because it seems to me it's very important to understand that each book of the Bible, I had on there before the books of the Bible, but each book of the Bible has a unique audience. And it was written to a particular group of people at a particular time for a particular reason. And it helps to understand those reasons and what's going on at that time in order to know what the Bible is saying to them. And that certainly would help us understand what the Bible is saying to us all these years later. So if we want to understand it better, we need to understand their world. And that's the purpose of the series. We've gone through the beginnings, Mesopotamia and Egypt, Israel, from Canaan to a kingdom, or from Egypt to Canaan and kingdom, exile and return. And today we're going to look into the intertestamental world, the world between the books that, like Micah, that we're just reading from in the Bible reading, and the New Testament. And then we'll have one more after that. Let's a very quick review. I guess most of you have heard these, but if you haven't, this is a summary. I assume that the sermons are online where you can listen to them. The Bible, and this is just a picture of the empires that surrounded Israel, or the land where Israel ended up being. They weren't all powerful at the same time. Sometimes one was in the dominance, one another in the dominance, and so forth. Eventually, Assyria was the biggest one of all of these that are here. But what we need to understand is that the Bible is not a world history book. It doesn't pretend to be. It's not trying to be. It's concerned with the ancient Near East, which is this area right here that I have in that particular map. And the concerns of those people are, who are we? Where do we come from? Who are our neighbors? Where did they come from? How did this all come to be, the situation that we see around us? What about the great powers? What does God have in mind for them? And just reading some of that in the book of Micah today, what is coming in the future? Excuse me. We also looked at the Mesopotamian worldview, if you want to put it that way, had gods that are a lot like humans. They're like spoiled humans with a lot of bad characteristics. And that the humans, we are here to serve the gods' needs. That was the prevailing worldview. But we saw that, of course, Yahweh, the Bible, the God of the Bible, was not needy at all. And he doesn't have the negative characteristics of humans. And in the very beginning of the book, in Genesis, go to the trouble to point those things out so that we can see right away from the very beginning that the Bible's taking a contrary position to the prevailing worldview. We saw also that the Bible takes for granted a spirit world that works behind the scenes for both good and bad, and that those gods are real. The false gods are real in a sense. And I commented to and talked about at length, I think, that there's no secular world. There's no world apart from the religious world. Gods were involved in all aspects of life. Serving them was as normal as getting up out of bed in the morning. And who the gods were and your relationship with them was part of everyone's identity. It was just the way the world was. And then we move on to the, to the second part. A very quick review of this. We talked about Abraham, who came from around here, okay, and then he headed up this way with his father actually. And the point was that they came down to here to Palestine, where Israel was going to end up and all, and made a few trips back and forth to Egypt. The point being, though, that he wasn't alone. Not only did he have a huge group that he traveled with, there were many other people migrating in the same direction, and some of them staying here. Some of them moving all the way down to the Nile Delta. Excuse me. And this is due to periods of instability. If things are unstable here, and you hear they're stable in Egypt, you hear, then why not go to Egypt? Why are things stable in Egypt? Well, one of the reasons is because we have the Nile River and the Nile Delta, which made for good crops all the time. The Asiatics, that's anybody from the east that did this migration ended up here in the Delta. They were separate from the rest of the people. Why? Because they were nomadic herdsmen, and the Egyptians in general worshipped these animals and wouldn't want to be around them in the way that the Asiatic people were. So there were many people down here, not just the children of Abraham, and many people from the same place that Abraham was from. And when the pharaohs decided that they didn't want to have that many Asiatics that were free to join with their enemies or whatever might happen, put them to work building the treasure cities, it wasn't just Israelites that were doing it. There was a mixed multitude, it says. You know, when they came out of Egypt, they came out with a mixed multitude. So there were a lot of people that came out at the same time the children of Abraham did. Here's an idea of what Palestine was like at the time of the Exodus. And these are Philistine cities right down here. So they weren't going to go this way. They weren't going to go this way because these people seem to be a little bit ahead of the curve on using iron and other technologies. And they were warlike. And Moses or God had the wisdom, and Moses seemed to understand too that this wouldn't be the best way to go because of them being there. So they wandered a different direction and ended up going around and entering the Promised Land through here. That's probably all I want to say here. But this Exodus was, again, a group of a mixed multitude. In the New American Standard that I quoted before, it even calls them rabble. Now, some of them, I guess they weren't viewed in a positive light. When they got to this area, and they came up past the Dead Sea and entered the what we call the Promised Land this way, these are highlands. You can see a slightly different color. There were battles, and you read about Jericho, and you read about Ai, and you read about different places. But then later on, it was just a matter of settling. You don't read stories of big conquests and big battles. And since there were also other people who had migrated that stayed here and didn't move on down to the Delta, there were people here that were kind of like them, spoke the same language and that they could get along with. Some of the areas here in what we know as Israel were not assimilated into the nation until the time of David and even Solomon. Jerusalem, for example, David conquered Jerusalem. It was a Jebusite city, and it stayed a Jebusite city all the way through Joshua and Judges and the early the books of Samuel and so forth. So the settlement of the land took a long period of time. They didn't conquer it in a week or a month or even a year or a lot of years. It took a long time before they settled the whole land, and they didn't conquer it all. They blended in with some of it. There is not archaeological evidence of a lot of battles here. There is archaeological evidence of battles as they entered, though. What kept them together? They didn't have a king, didn't have a national leader. Sometimes they had prophets like Samuel, but even then, that's not exactly what kept them together, but it was the covenant that they had, the covenant that they had made with God at Sinai, and also a shared history, a common history coming from Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. Yahweh's covenant, as I pointed out, was with Israel, was in the form of a suzerainty treaty. I've done this for you, therefore you do this for me. And in the commandment we see, I'm the God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, so don't have any other gods before me. It's a perfect example of that. The nation, or the people of Israel, were subject to God. They owed him their allegiance. They owed him their tribute, if you want to put it that way. That was a common way of looking at things in that time. How did they get to a monarchy where you had kings and their children became the next king? Well, that took a while. That took a while. And the Bible, interestingly enough, preserves both sides of the opinions about how it worked. To me, and I like sharing this, especially with young people, that's what makes the Bible so believable, that it doesn't exclude viewpoints that maybe everyone didn't agree with. It preserves the negative information about its heroes. David's one of the great heroes of the Bible. Abraham, another hero of the Bible. Moses, a hero of the Bible. The Bible preserves their faults, their sins. You read other ancient documents, and they don't preserve the bad news about their heroes, but the Bible does. And that, to me, makes it more believable. Anyway, they ended up with a king. King Saul, in a time of crisis, because Philistines, they were battling the Philistines all the time. But Saul's, in a way, is a not a burdensome king. He's not. He doesn't draft a huge army. He doesn't tax the people heavily. He's not hard on the people. That happens later under Solomon. The monarchy is a work in progress. They don't really, they haven't figured out, is the son going to automatically be the king or not? Those things took time. They took time to solve and become the way they ended up for good or for bad sometimes, depending on which king it was. Of course, we know that the kingdom split after Solomon. You had Judah and you had Israel to the north. Judah had less people, had less territory, but it had a Davidic dynasty where each king was the son or a relative of the king before. That wasn't the case in Israel. Israel kept the, you know, that when somebody would get assassinated, then it'd be a different dynasty that would start. In Judah, that wasn't the case. You had children of David. And they began to trust in that dynasty, and along with, they had an attachment to the land and to Zion. And you were just, we're just reading that in Micah today, where they said, you know, these things can't happen to Zion. Bad can't happen to Zion. That's what you think. Why? Because it's the land, and we got a son of David on the throne, and God's got to take care of us. No, he doesn't. And they didn't understand that. But the prophets kept telling them, you know, you can't depend on the temple or depend on the land or depend on the king. You got to depend on God, and you got to obey God. Israel goes through many dynasties, as I said. Some of them actually grew to be quite great in the regionally, and the children of Omri, that's one, where that went on for a period of time, and Israel expanded its boundaries and actually was quite powerful for a little while there. All the while, though, Assyria, as I mentioned before, was gaining power, getting larger, and time was running out for both Israel and Judah. And that's what we talked about in the next sermon. The next presentation, we talked about exile and return, that Israel was finally, of course, it was divided into two kingdoms, and there was a threat to the north, which was the kingdom of Assyria, which was a huge empire eventually. This is the Assyrian Empire after it conquered Judah and Israel. But look, it was a huge empire, much larger than Babylon was, much larger than earlier empires. And they were, well, I went through this. They were organized. They were efficient. They were warlike. They were empire building. They were ruthless, and they destroyed cultures. And they would send people away and bring other people in so that there'd be no resistance. They were mean. It was a mean kingdom. So that growing Assyria to the north, the prophets to Israel warned. They warned Israel about it because there was a breakdown in society. Things were not right. So Hosea, Amos, Isaiah, for instance, preached for years that, you know, the breakdown of law and order was bad and it needed to be changed. Immorality, the political infighting, every man for himself, social injustice, not taking care of the weak and the infirm and so forth, and pagan worship. And, you know, because of all those things, the country's doomed. God is not going to let it go on forever. And he didn't. He didn't. Of course, Israel went into captivity. And Assyria conquered Israel and deported some of the people and brought some others back in. That's where you get the Samaritans. It's a mixture of the people of the land and the people that were brought in, at least some of the Samaritans. But there was more than one deportation. And the people were deported up here into the Tigris-Euphrates region. Later on, when the Jews go, they're going to go further south. So Israel's up here, at least initially. Judah remained a nation down here for over a century after the conquering of Israel. This is just a chart that I showed that shows that, you know, Assyria got to be quite big in power, but the last Assyrian king goes about 609. Israel was conquered in about 621. Then you've got the Babylonians that ruled for a short period of time, about 100 years. And after that, you had the Persian Empire. So the Assyrians conquered Israel, but it was going to be the Babylonians that conquered Judah later. And you read in the Bible reading today, and you have been reading, some of the prophets that prophesied to Judah. Joel, Micah, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, even Jeremiah a little later on. They're all prophesying before the captivity, and they are warning Judah that the same sins that caused the demise of Israel are going to cause the demise of Judah. And don't count on your, Jeremiah, I think, said it. Don't count on the temple. Don't count on the land. Don't count on the fact that you have a Davidic king on the throne. Those are not going to save you. It's these sins that are going to do you in, regardless. The people didn't heed that. They didn't heed. They really believed in the land. They believed in those kinds of things. And it was very important to them. Very important. So, the kingdom of Judah, those people were taken captive as well. They were, some of them were exported, if you want to put it that way, to Babylon. Okay, and even a little bit further toward the Persian Gulf. And you know, why did they take? They took the best people. They took the smart people. They took people like Daniel. You know, the Persians took people like Daniel. And why did they want people like that? Why you didn't want to leave the smart people there? You know, they have the people that are most likely to rebel against your reign over them. You want to get rid of them. You want to use them. You want to keep, what's the expression? Keep your enemies, or keep your friends close and your enemies even closer. So you bring the people that are most likely to lead a revolution to your capital and put them to work. And you got where you can watch them. And that's what they did. That's what they did. What were they supposed to do when they were in Babylon? Well, I'm not sure what they were doing, but Jeremiah wrote them a letter. And he said, you know, build houses, live in them, take wives, become fathers of sons and daughters, seek the welfare of the city where I've sent you. And in other words, make a life there. And I will visit you after 70 years and bring you back. Fact is, though, they didn't all come back. There were a lot of people who stayed, just a few people came back. And we had the beginning of what's known as a diaspora, where you had Jewish communities that started spreading out over the globe. The first one, significant one anyway, being in Babylon, right here. Now, this is the map of the Persian Empire. So we said that the Assyrian Empire was big because it had this area. Well, look at the Persian Empire. It's the largest empire that had been known up to that time. And they were good administrators. They allowed people to be themselves, to kind of govern themselves a little bit, or at least have some say in how they were governed. And as long as you weren't rebellious and you could practice your own religion. The Persians were kind of the opposite of the Assyrians in that way, in how they managed their empire. And they built infrastructure, good roads. You could get mail from here to here in, you know, I forget what it was, a couple of weeks or whatever. It was amazing. They had a Pony Express. And it was the beginning of an organized, well-administrated governing system. It was a good example for Rome later. I don't know. I was going to delete this slide, but this talks about how they administered their empire. Well, then some of the Jews were allowed to come back. All right, and here's the guess of how they came back to Jerusalem, and they were allowed to rebuild the city and rebuild the temple. And this is important. So now we have two large Jewish communities, right? We've got two of them. We've got one in Babylon. We've got one in Jerusalem. It's just the beginning of what, as I said, is known as the diaspora. And this is where we dropped off. Now we're ready for the next phase of our presentation here. And that's the intertestamental period, the period between the prophets and when Jesus comes on the scene. And this is a very interesting period. It's important to understand what goes on here. We don't have a whole lot of time to do it, but we want to understand what's going on because it will affect the world in which Jesus preaches, and it affects the way people think. So let's get going. As I said, there's two centers of Jewish population, Jerusalem and Babylon. But the Bible, once again, is interested in what? It's interested in what's going on in Jerusalem. So Babylon becomes less important. You don't read about Babylon in the Bible in terms of the Jewish community there. You read a little bit, but you read a lot more about what's going on in Jerusalem because that's where the focus of the Bible is. Again, the Bible's not trying to be a world history book and cover what's going on everywhere. But we do read about the rebuilding of Jerusalem, rebuilding of the wall, rebuilding of the temple. And we have some prophets still. During Reconstruction, you have more prophets. You've got Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi that are preaching after the captivity. And so you still have prophets. And they're telling us that's one of the sources where we learn about what's going on in the circumstances of these of the rebuilding. The temple was rebuilt, the sacrifices are restarted, and then what? Are we in the dark until we get to the New Testament? How do we know anything more? Well, we have Josephus, we have Philo, we have the Apocrypha, books like the Maccabees and all that are not part of the Protestant Bible, but are part of the Catholic and Orthodox Bible. We have Greek and Roman historians that wrote about it. We have some information from the Dead Sea Scrolls. We have the Pseudepigrapha, which is books like, the Testament of Moses or something like that. Obviously not written by Moses, but written many, thousands of years later or a hundred, centuries later by somebody else. But they still have some information in there that we can glean about this period of time. There's also Targums, which are commentaries in Aramaic and rabbinic literature that talk about a little bit about this period. So we're not in the dark totally about the history of this. We can know some of the things that went on, but we don't have biblical books, at least not in the Protestant Bible. We do have Maccabees and so on, like I said, the apocryphal books that give us information about this time. Interesting and important information. So what was going on during this time? And what effect did these events have on the New Testament? And the answer is in one word, and it's, if you don't remember anything else from this sermon, remember this: Hellenization. This is the definition from Wikipedia. The historical spread of ancient Greek culture, religion, and to a lesser extent the language, over foreign peoples conquered by Greeks or brought into their sphere of influence, particularly during the Hellenistic period following the campaigns of Alexander the Great in the 4th century BC. Hellenization. That's what's happening in the world during this period of time. I say the world, the ancient Near East, that part of the world. Actually, not just the ancient Near East, but on into Europe and all the way to the Indus River, all the way to India. That's what's going on. And that's what's going on in the land of Palestine and in Jerusalem. Hellenization. Becoming more like the Greeks. What is Hellenization? It's from the Greek Helen. It's just E-L-E, lambda, whatever. Epsilon, lambda, epsilon, nu, or something like that. And it just means Greek. It's from that word. So Hellenization is becoming like a Greek. And that's what was going on. Let's talk about Alexander the Great for a little while. We could talk about him forever. He's a very interesting character. Alexander III of Macedon, he lived from 356 to 323 BC. Didn't live to be very old. See that, right? Not that old. He succeeded his father, Philip II, who was assassinated by the captain of his bodyguards. That's a common way that kings stopped their reign, is that somebody killed him. He came to the throne of Macedonia at age 20. He already had a pretty good reputation when his father was killed. He spent most of his short reign on a military campaign. He wasn't ruling in Macedonia. He was off to the races. I mean, he was off conquering lands. That was kind of his destiny. He had a mother that told him he was destined to do some of that in Africa and Asia. And he created one of the largest empires in the ancient world. And he did it all before he was 30. So if you feel like you haven't accomplished much, you're right. No, I'm just kidding. This guy, he's 30 and he's conquered the what was the known world for those in that part of the world. I mean, there are other parts of the world that they didn't know about that much. And he would have gone further. What happened? Everybody know? Why didn't he go further? When he got to India, what happened? He had homesick troops. They kind of rebelled. Like, we're going home. You stay here if you want, but we're going. And so he gave up. But how do you reign, how do you rule that? How do you you get so big? Well, I don't know that he was so worried about it, but one of the things he did is he spread that Greek culture. That's what motivated him, to spread that Greek culture around the world. He understood Greek culture. He had lots of good tutors. And then when he was 13, from the time he was 13 to 16, he was tutored by Aristotle. And here's somebody that could teach you about everything. And it wasn't just him. It was the Eton, the school, the prep school where all the elite kids go. Well, he at Aristotle's school, there were a bunch of kids there, and these are the people that became his generals and his confidants in his, I was going to say in his old age. He never lived to be old age, but when he was an adult. And Aristotle taught him everything. Taught him medicine, philosophy, morals, religion, logic, and art. I got it from one book. By the way, this is I don't think I got it from this book. This is one of the source resources. I used Wikipedia. I used other books I have, but this is a good one. Understanding the Big Picture of the Bible. It's written by several different people and has a couple of chapters on this period of time. And this one goes through the whole Bible. Anyway, Alexander wasn't just a leader or a general, but he was he was taught in philosophy and art and all these things too. A polymath in ways. Now, let's continue on talking about Alexander the Great. I said about his desire to spread the culture. This is amazing. He never lost a battle. Never. And he was often outnumbered, and he knew it. He's just smarter. And sometimes more foolish, if you want to put it that way. He was willing to take risks that other people wouldn't take, but that surprised his enemies. Never lost a battle. He was a military genius. He's still viewed as a military genius. He conquered the huge Persian Empire that we showed you before, but then much more. He created an empire that stretched all the way from Greece in Europe all the way to India, and he stopped only because of his troops. He died at age 33. He got sick. Nobody knows exactly what from. The different ancient historians debate it, and nobody knows. And he died with no obvious heir. His only son was born after he died, actually. So there was nobody to turn his kingdom over to. He's supposed to have said, when he was asked, "So who gets your kingdom?" He said, "To the strongest," or something like that. There's no proof that he said that, but that's the story that's in the ancient historians. So it was divided among his generals, four of his generals. They fought over it. It wasn't divided peacefully. They fought. I think they had a bit of something allotted to them, but then they fought. And here's a picture of this is a much bigger picture of the more of the world included, but the Persian Empire, or put it, the Assyrian Empire would have been here. The Persian Empire was more like this. And look at his empire, all the way over to India, northwest India, all the way over here into Greece, Macedonia, down into Egypt. It was huge. And all of this area wasn't just conquered by him, but they started to speak Greek, at least in official business. They started to dress like Greeks. They started to think like Greeks. They started to have schools like Greeks. They have games like Greeks. It was a spread of the culture. And the historians say that in certain areas, that Greek influence and culture lasted until the 20th century. So it's just an amazing thing. And it was you look at the big picture again, it was a good precursor to what was to become the Roman Empire. And the Roman Empire was important. I don't know how much I'm going to talk about this, but it was important because, and the same with Alexander's empire, there was peace. You could walk on the road or ride on the road, and go between nations and in relative safety. They had roads. They had infrastructure, starting with the Persian Empire and then with the Romans. So it was a world in which Jesus could preach and travel locally, and a world in which Paul and the apostles could travel far and wide. So it needed to happen that way. That's the way God intended. But Alexander the Great was one of the early people that was involved in bringing this to pass through having a large section of the world under Greek control and then spreading the common Greek language. See, the gospel spread in the Greek language. Why? Because everybody spoke Greek. Whoops, I didn't mean to do that. Everybody spoke Greek. So all these people, the gospel could spread in one language. Now, that wasn't their first language, I understand. And maybe the commoner, the people working in the fields maybe didn't speak Greek, but the educated people did, and the people that were involved in trade and so forth. And that's how, you remember, that's how Paul preached the gospel. He'd set up a tent-making business, and he'd be in the square or wherever it was, in the markets, and he'd share the gospel that way. Well, when the generals split up Alexander's empire, you had one that was kind of responsible. I keep hitting the wrong button, sorry. You had one that was responsible for Greece, and he stayed there and kept things together somewhat. You had one here further in Asia Minor, And then you had this huge area that was controlled by what are called the Seleucids. And then you had Egypt, which was the Ptolemies. And once again, as happens again and again, the whole story of the Bible until you get to the Roman Empire, is that the place where God's people were is in the way. It's in between. So when this guy down here, the Ptolemies, are fighting the Seleucids, which happened often, guess who's in the middle? And it was that way. We've already gone through that. Some of the other empires that we had, there were battles that go on, and the Jews are in the middle in this case. Notice this map, and I wrote down whose map this is, from the University of Texas Library. And I didn't get a chance to talk to anybody and find out why they did this. But notice that the blue indicates Egyptian control, but then this is supposed to indicate, or the Ptolemies here, this is supposed to indicate Seleucid control. This is supposed to be 301 BC. I'm not sure why it's drawn that way, but the fact is that at different periods of time, it flipped back and forth. It depended on who they were allied with, who they were connected with. And there were times when it would be controlled more from here, times it would be controlled from here. And for the most part, I'll wait to talk about that. But the point is, it's in the middle. It's in the middle as usual. King of North, King of the South. You read about it, right, in Daniel. There's a North and a South, and they're on, and we happen to be in the middle, and we're going to be trampled over every time. This is just a neat chart. The house of Antigonus, the house of Ptolemy. Antigonus would be up around Greece. The Ptolemaic leaders, which would be Egypt, and the Seleucid leaders, which would be up in Assyria, Babylon, Mesopotamia. And there are a lot of them, right, through a period of time. And they all lasted for a good while, for a couple centuries at least. We're going to talk about a few of them in particular right here, Antiochus. And then the famous Cleopatra, she's in here too. And there's more. That's Cleopatra the First. That's not the famous one. Later on, we have another Cleopatra, but she's involved too. So here's a little bit more of a close-up. You have the Seleucids here, and you have the Ptolemies here. And at this particular map, the Palestine is controlled by the Ptolemies. So it depends on, again, when you draw the map. But this time, which would be the 3rd century B.C., did I get that right? Yeah. There's not a whole lot that we know about what was going on, except that the Jews were pretty much left alone. It's not that they ruled themselves. They were subject to the Ptolemies, but they were kind of left alone to run their affairs as long as they didn't cross Egypt in some kind of a way. By the way, here's Alexandria, named after Alexander the Great. Anybody want to guess how many cities founded and named after himself?
16.
Is it 16? I read it was like as many as 20. I don't know, but it's 16. Okay. He wasn't embarrassed to name cities after himself. They're all over the place. This one's an important city. A lot of Jews ended up here later on. I guess if you conquer the world, you get to name the cities. I don't know. But here you got this, it's in the middle. And at this point, when this map is drawn, which is what, around 240 BC, the Ptolemies have control of the area. But it flipped back and forth. Palestine's in the middle. Yeah, I got all this here. Oh, one of the reasons that they were granted a lot of latitude and actually sometimes received gifts from the Ptolemies is that they were a buffer state. It's kind of like, well, if somebody's got to attack, they got to go through here first. So let's get that. We want these people to be our friends. So we pay them a little bit. Yesterday, my guys showed up at a house to trim, and the cabinet people were already there. They already had their cabinets all over the place. I was like, oh, no, what are we going to do? And they call me up, and I was at a different job. I said, I'll be over there in 10 or 15 minutes. So I get there, and the cabinet guy seems to be all right. He might think I'm the supervisor. I'm not really sure. But he was okay, and I gave him a few bucks, And he said, so we're going to take it at first. And I told my guys, I said, we want them on our side. And so there was no problem the rest of the day. You give them a little bit of money. Everybody's happy. They can go have lunch with their money or whatever. But that's the same thing here. The Ptolemies were nice to the Jews because they were a bit of a buffer. You know, so why not have them on your side? This is where I got the note. Many Jews went to Alexandria and established a large Jewish community in Alexandria. And you read about that in the New Testament. You know, there's different ones of the disciples that were from Alexandria because there were a lot of Jews there. And what happened is that there were times when it wasn't peaceful here, and to escape, just like Abraham, you know, to escape the commotion, they migrated. They just went ahead and migrated. And they found peace down here and prosperity. Here's another map. This one's supposed to be 188 BC, and you see that the Seleucid kingdom has control of the whole coast here, Palestine, all the way down to Egypt. So it went back and forth. And sometimes it depended on who you were allied with. Sometimes you get some help because you make a treaty with somebody else, and that, you know, and there, I won't go into all the details, but the point is, it wasn't simple. And especially if you're in the middle like this, it would flip back and forth. After, you know, when you get to the 2nd century BC, in the 100s, the Seleucids controlled the coast here. They could control where the Jews live. Everything changed because the Egyptians, the Ptolemies, let the Jews be, and they could do their own thing. The Seleucids weren't about to do that. They were like Alexander the Great on steroids. They forced Hellenization. They forced it. And what do I mean by that? Well, there were several reasons. One is that in some battles here, the Seleucid Empire had control of what's called Asia Minor, Turkey, right? They lost that in some battles. Now, when you lose territory, what do you lose? Money. You lose the tribute. You lose the tax, okay? That's all. That's what my friends in Burma said. What are they fighting about? What are the fights about? I said, it's about money. It's who controls the territory gets the payola. Well, that's never changed. It's always been that way. So, less tax from here, need more from here. So the Seleucids started up in the tribute and pressured them in other ways. Now, one of the reasons they lost Asia Minor and one of the reasons they were under pressure is because we have a whole new republic up here that's getting more powerful called Rome. At this time, it was ruled by the Senate. And Rome was a factor. And when it came to geopolitical considerations, you had to think about what Rome cared about. So Rome was interested in what's going on down here and here. They didn't want too much power. And they began to become involved. This is just the beginning of it. Let's get back to Hellenization. What did the Seleucids do? The Greek institutions were established in Palestine. It means they started, you know, wanted to do things like build gyms or whatever, have certain Greek culture, the games and so forth. The diaspora communities in Egypt and elsewhere adopted Greek culture. So the Jews are becoming more like Greeks. Okay? In the Bible, when you read about Jews and Greeks, that word for Greek just kind of means Gentiles. But here we're talking about people that are adopting Greek culture. The elite Jews would send their children to prep schools, to secondary schools that taught Greek culture, all right, in Greek. They learned the Greek language. Many of the Jews adopted Greek dress and customs, even names. When you read the history, you'll say this person was appointed to be the high priest, and he was a Greek sympathizer. Well, yeah, his name's Jason, you know. The other guy's name was Onias or something like that. They had Jewish names, they had Hebrew names, and they had Greek names, as you could tell sometimes from their names which side they were on. Those that were involved in government or trade needed to use the Greek language. Not everyone was happy about this. You know, the guy on the street in general, the average layman was not thrilled about this Hellenization. There was considerable resistance to it. And as a result, there came to be factions among the Jews, parties you could call it, that were divided over their response to Hellenization. Should we participate in it or should we fight it? And this is going on in the second century, in the second century BC. And it's going to get worse because not only do we have the Seleucids, but then we got Antiochus the Fourth, Epiphanes. Who knows what Epiphanes means? You know, did you learn that one? It means like God manifest. All right? These guys thought themselves as God or a God. He desired to unify his empire, just like Alexander did, with Greek culture. But he was willing to do it forcefully. So what did he do? He rewarded the Jews who were friends of Hellenization. He'd give them power. He'd give them, he'd make them the, because he had the power, he'd make them the high priest or their family. He rewarded the Jews that were on his side. He killed, oftentimes killed opponents. When he came to visit Jerusalem, he was welcomed by the elites. He's like a hero. He had a campaign in Egypt, which actually hadn't gone very well. But then he comes to Jerusalem, and it's said that they even offered him some of the treasures from the rebuilt temple. But, you know, the average Jew didn't like this. He then outlawed circumcision, Sabbath, clean and unclean meat laws. He destroyed the scrolls. He ordered people to eat pigs. He was forcing Greek culture on the Jews. And you can imagine that this wasn't going over well. He set up an idol in the temple. He sacrificed pigs there. He appointed non-Zadokite high priests. They've been from the family of Zadok since David's time. And you could be high priest if you had enough money. Just basically had to pay him off, and then your family could have the high priesthood. This is Antiochus Epiphanes. This is very important because this is the second century BC history of the Jews, and this is very fresh in their minds at the time of Jesus and the time of the apostles. So what happened? Well, there was this guy named Mattathias, and he was a priest, and he was asked by a Greek government official under Antiochus to offer sacrifice to the Greek gods. Mattathias refused to do it, and then he got somebody else to do it, the government guy. And Mattathias killed the Jew who made the sacrifice, and then he went and killed the guy from the government. And then guess what he had to do? He had to run, right? He had to run to the hills, and that's what he did. But he wasn't alone. He had five brave sons, and there were a whole bunch of other people that joined to their cause. And they became known as the Maccabees. This is supposed to be the tomb of Mattathias, I think. No. Yes, Mattathias. It's supposed to be Mattathias' tomb. Who knows? So he headed for the hills, and then they began a guerrilla war. You know, under a war not with big troops and big armies facing off, but just, you know, knock them off when you can. And it started under Mattathias. And he died, the leadership passed to his son Judas, and there were several. There was Simon, there was Jonathan, there were all these sons. And Judas was the one who took the name Maccabeus, and that means the main meaning, it could mean some other things, but the main meaning is hammer, Judas the hammer. By 165, Judas had defeated this general Lysias during a period of much distraction in the empire. Now, I got to explain that a little bit. You know, Mattathias and his sons and the people that were with him had nothing even close to the power of the Seleucid government. They weren't going to be able to beat them. But there was a lot going on back home, back where headquarters was, and Antiochus had to be back there. Parthia was kind of involved and supporting the Jews. You know, there's even people that think that there are a lot of Israelites there in Parthia. I don't know. But the point is that Antiochus was distracted, and he might not have still been king. I think he was, though. But whatever the king was, he was distracted, and he couldn't put all of his attention to this Jewish revolt. And as a result, the Jews won and were kind of let alone. And the temple was rededicated. This is a special temple menorah. I didn't know there was such a thing, but during Hanukkah, they add an extra lamp, or that's a candle there, but they had an extra lamp to the top during Hanukkah. But the rededication of the temple was cleansed, and there were sacrifices restarted in 165 BC under Judas. That's the origin of Hanukkah. We've talked about that before. If you look at John chapter 10, it says that they were at the temple at the Feast of Dedication. That's Hanukkah. It wasn't all peaceful. It wasn't all, you know, good yet. There were internal and external battles. That is, fighting among the Jews themselves about who was going to be in charge, and external battles for the next 15 years. And finally, another brother, Jonathan, secures independence, and he does that both through his their military abilities, but also through an alliance with Egypt, which helped. And Jonathan makes himself high priest. But he's not from the high priestly family. He's not from the family of Aaron. So here we go again. You know, it's like, what you have is you have a lot of political stuff going on. And this is the beginning of a dynasty that's called the Hasmonean dynasty. And these are all descendants of Mattathias. And they make themselves high priests. They take whatever. Now, this map here just happens to be, it starts out being just the area around Jerusalem over to the Jordan. And then it grows. It grows under the different ones that are... You got Jonathan, you got Simon, who's another one of Mattathias' sons, and then you got Hyrcanus, and you have different people here in Aristobulus. These are all descendants of Mattathias, and it's called the Hasmonean dynasty. I guess I'll leave it at that for now. The great powers of the world kind of left them alone. They were occupied with their own issues, their own tension. At this time, from 140 to about 116 BC, Rome, which was becoming more and more powerful, was also beginning to have problems, not knowing exactly what to do. It's still the Senate ruling it, but there's going to be problems coming because here we got, the Hasmonean dynasty. The Jews were independent, basically, from 110 to 63. But what you have is they became a client of Rome through the Senate. But Rome's internal issues, they started having issues because of Julius Caesar wanting to be emperor instead of just being up there in Gaul, wherever they had sent him to be a general. They also had this alliance with Parthia. So the Jews had a lot of freedom at this time. But it's because Rome kind of let them alone until 63 BC. After 63, and we're about wrapping up here, the Herodian dynasty began. And I think Jim's talked about the Herods before, and I've mentioned them. You got to mention them a little bit, but good old Herod the Great. He was an Idumean. He was raised as a Jew, but he wasn't really, in a sense, he wasn't. But he was shrewd. He knew who to align himself with, and when he picked the wrong side, he could flip it around and pick the right side quickly. He had to do that with Caesar, with Antony and Octavian. He knew how to play the game. He was very political. He was also ruthless. He executed many members of his own family, including his wife at one point. The wife that he had married, who was related to the Hasmoneans, he had her executed. I forget who it was. I didn't look it up. Was it Mark Antony that said it's safer to be Herod's pig than it is to be his relative?
Or it was Augustus.
It could have been Augustus. Yeah, okay, Augustus. Somebody said it. Okay, I'll trust Jim. Augustus said it. He's not going to harm a pig because he's not going to eat it, but if you're in his family, it's a good chance you might get killed. His rule ended the Hasmonean dynasty, and then you had the rule of the Herods, which, I might talk about this a little bit in the last installment. The Herods ruled, but not really. I mean, they were allowed to rule by Rome. And at times, there were Herods that were ruling alongside a Roman governor. So the end of the Hasmonean dynasty is basically the end of today's presentation. And the next time that I am here, it'll be the New Testament in its Greek and Roman context. This Hellenization that took place is what sets the stage for Jesus' ministry, for the reaction of the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and how the Sadducees being the ones that were more Hellenized, and the Pharisees being more strict, saying, "Oh no, we can't do that, we can't do that." So this is what I've gone over today is what set the stage for what we see in the New Testament. Next time we'll get to the New Testament in its Greek and Roman context. I apologize. We have to leave right away. We old friend from church. We have to go see at on their anniversary down down south of here, so we have to leave right away. But